Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Worshipping Community Central. Really exciting to see you all. Great to have to get more chairs out. That's fantastic. Speaking with a few of you just now, I know we're not all sure exactly what it is we're doing here, what it is, where it is we're going. And that's great. We've come into this with lots of questions, and it's going to be a journey of learning together. What might be helpful is to have five subjects, sort of questions for the 5 weeks. And here they are. The first one, this first week, is why are we doing this? Then week two, where do we see God at work? Week three, how do we make disciples? Week four, how do we orient ourselves? And week five is, okay, so what will be? What's next? What are our kind of next steps along this road? And we've got some different people that are going to be helping us along the journey, people who've walked this road before, coaching us. Tonight we're going to be hearing from Nick Harding, leads a church called Frontline in Liverpool. Really inspiring guy. We're going to have Mal Callandine, who's spoken here at Hope in the past, also very experienced in this, is going to be helping us. And we'll be using some material from an American guy with a brilliant handlebar moustache called Cesar Kalinowski, a little bit along in a few weeks' time. And then there'll be others that will be helping us as well. So we're going to start in a minute by worshipping. And as you know, that's very much a part of the evening. And during that, we want to ask God to speak to us prophetically. So we're very excited. I'll just hand over to Alice quickly to say a few things.
Over these next 5 weeks of journeying together is really helpfully summed up in the phrase "family on mission." So I think we can tip into either being family, being believers together, following Jesus, connecting together, and that's it. Not really have a particular corporate community missional outlook. Or we can be family on mission, that we all have our own bits and pieces we're being missional in, whether it's in the workplace, projects on our hearts, whatever, but we're sort of on our own and not really doing it as family. So what we want to forge over the next few weeks is we are one family, we are Hope family, our identity is in Christ, and we are in this extended family at Hope, and we are on mission. And a lovely kind of thing to think about is how Jesus sent out the 72. He sent them all out together, they all went in pairs to different places, and then they all reported back together, shared stories, and were incredibly full of joy at all that the Lord had done with them and through them. And so, in a sense, they were family on mission, and that's what we want to see happen to us in this really exciting new season at Hope.
Lord, this is really exciting to be here. We've tasted something of you, we've encountered you personally, we've seen you do great things in the history of Hope Community Church, and we're so grateful. And we're excited about this learning season, particularly these 5 weeks of learning together as a church. We worship you, Jesus. Thank you that you're here with us.
Jesus, we're just so grateful for the privilege of partnership with you. Just so grateful that our food is to do the will of our Father, and it energizes us and sustains us when we come into full agreement and alignment with your precious, kind and liberating will for us. And so we pray your prayer that your will is done and your kingdom comes on earth amongst us in our lives and hearts tonight, that your governance of peace and joy is established and extended tonight through us on earth as it is in heaven. And I just know that there's been desert in this nation for many years, but the streams are beginning to come. The wells are beginning to be unstopped. And we're just so grateful that we live in a generation where we can partner with you in this, in unstopping the wells, those ancient wells that go back 1500 years and more, where the first seeds of the revelation of you were sown, and faithful generations have held it and stewarded it, passed down the baton generation after generation after generation. There's always been a remnant of faith, and we're just so grateful that we're part of that long history and we get the privilege of stewarding it for a season until we pass the baton on. Lord, we just want to be faithful. We want to give a good account of our season of stewardship. So we ask that you speak to us tonight, that we hear your kind, liberating, tender voice that literally forges the way ahead for us and enlightens us and lights up a path before us. Come, Holy Spirit. May your words be a lamp to our feet tonight. Connect us deeply with each other, deeply with each other, and deeply with you and your vision for us. Amen.
Wonderful. Great. Have a seat. Great to see you. Everyone got seats? In a minute, I'm going to come and hand some of these around. We're using journals for this course rather than sort of notes, because it's a five week journey for us together as a church. If it's helpful for you to have some headings, how about this? This might give a little bit of an indication of what we're doing. So here is the first question today, is kind of why are we doing this? And in a minute, I'm going to introduce Nick, who's speaking to us from Liverpool via Skype. And he's an inspired. I'll introduce him probably in a minute when he's here with us. So that's week one. Week two is going to be where do we see God at work? Week three, how do we make disciples? Week four, how do we orient ourselves? And week five, what will be? What are our next steps? And it's going to be very much a journey. So the idea is that in these journals, you can make notes of what God's saying to you, what's coming up in some of these little talks we'll be hearing. We've got some coaches that are going to be helping us on the journey, and Nick will be one of those. It's a chap called Mal Calladine is going to be helping us as well. And a guy with a very interesting moustache called Cesar Kalinowski. He's written a book, which is a really good book, actually. He's going to help us a bit as well. So there's a little book suggestion. You don't have to read any of these. It's only if you'd like to. But you could slot this. It's perfectly sized to slot into your journal, if you want to put that into there. So I think, and then people have got meals. Those of you who, I think there's about seven people that have ordered meals. I think there's a few others as well, if you want some food. And so do come and grab it over here. Shirley's kindly made that. And Aaron and Tracy particularly serving it, and Annie. So you can grab that now, and while we dial in to Nick. And so let's try that now, shall we? So if I didn't introduce Nick to us, Nick is up in Liverpool, and we thought it would be easier than driving down here and then driving back up again, which is about, I don't know, 4 hours, 5 hours each way, if Nick could join us like this. And I think it's the image is good, isn't it? And we can hear him. But I heard Nick speak to a group of church leaders in Bristol, about 60 church leaders in Bristol, in Dave Mitchell's living room. He's the pastor at Woodlands, before Christmas, I think it was. And I was really inspired by his story. The church that he leads up in, or has led in the past up in Liverpool, called Frontline. And I thought actually it'd be a really good starter for us with Woko Central to hear what Nick has to say. So I'm going to hand over to you now, Nick, and then I will mute our end. And we're looking forward to hearing from you. Is that okay?
Okay. Thank you very much. It's great to be with you, and I'm enjoying having a little bit of me in Bristol. Having lived in Bristol for 19 years, it's a city very dear to my heart. In fact, my aunt and uncle used to live just up the road from where you are in Hope Square. So your area is quite familiar to me. And a little bit of my own background is that I was in a past life a doctor, a GP in Filton in Bristol, and had that practice for about 10 years. Before we moved to Liverpool to plant a church 25 years ago, so I gave up medicine about 23 years ago. The church we planted in Liverpool was a church we just started with a dozen people in our front room. That's gradually grown over the years to about 1,000 adults and children. We've gone on quite a long journey. We've always had a real heart to be missional. We've always tried to find different ways to reach out to people. We've always had a heart to make disciples. But we've often found we've been frustrated in those desires for a whole variety of reasons. I thought it might be helpful just to share some of my perceptions with you tonight. Hopefully it'll stimulate some thinking, maybe generate some questions. Oh, just also to say, I am married, and I have 4 grown-up daughters and 7 gorgeous grandchildren. So I'm a very blessed man. And you can't take that away from me. So whatever you think of me tonight, I am loved by my family. So as we've wrestled with these issues of mission and discipleship over the years, we've sort of come to various conclusions. And I think, you know, if I'm going to speak anything that is lifeful to you tonight, then I have to start by posing what's the problem, because there's nothing worse than trying to bring a solution where there's no perceived problem. So the problem I see it, or the question that I think we're trying to address is why are we struggling with mission and discipleship? What is it about mission and discipleship that is so difficult for us as Christians and as churches? And I want to just suggest a few thoughts as to why that might be, and to see whether you resonate with any of those ideas. Then I'll just talk a little bit about some of the expressions of mission, discipleship and community that are going on here in Liverpool and around. Open it up for any questions afterwards. So my first thought is that one of the problems with mission and discipleship is that we tend to operate those two areas in different silos. We see them as different activities. We don't really understand how to join up the dots. When we think about mission, we think about short-term trips, local evangelistic events, alpha courses, social action activity. That's kind of all in one compartment. Then over here in another compartment is things we call discipleship, which might be pastoral care, Bible study, kind of growing into maturity courses, Sunday teaching programs, all of those things that we think are about helping to mature established Christians. And I think the conclusion I've come to is that they were never meant to be separate. They were meant to be part of one integrated process, which Jesus called making disciples. And if we go back to Matthew 28, the Great Commission, and I'm trusting that I can stand on some mutually agreed ground, which is that making disciples is our primary task while we're here on planet Earth. Our greatest calling is obviously to worship the Lord and to have an intimate relationship with him, but that goes on forever into eternity. But whilst on planet Earth, the primary thing that Jesus has given us to do is to make disciples. Go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to obey all that I have taught you. And clearly the implication there is that what Jesus has just taught them, the very last thing he taught them about going and making disciples, is something that is passed on to each generation of disciples. So we could say that we're actually called not just to be makers of disciples, but makers of disciple makers. If we unpack that a little more. And if we think about this as an integrated process, I like the way Colin Dye from Kensington Temple puts it. He talks about the 5 steps in disciple making, unpacking that verse in Matthew 28. He talks about making, marking, maturing, mobilizing, and multiplying. If you like alliteration, you'll like that. If you don't, I'm sorry. So making disciples is about going and finding the people of peace, the people that God's prepared for us, those who are leaning into us, listening to us, like us, have got some spiritual openness, maybe even serving us as the people of peace were in Luke chapter 10. So it's starting off to finding those people of peace, creating ways in which they can come to faith, giving them those opportunities, modeling to them what it looks like to be a Jesus follower and inviting them onto the journey of following Jesus. Once they've kind of crossed that line, even if we never know quite when it is, there's the marking, which is baptism. They're marked at baptism. They nail their colors to the mast. Then the maturing, which relates to the teaching part of that scripture, And then the implications of the ongoing teaching them to obey what I've obeyed you is the mobilizing them into the mission and seeing them multiply into further disciple makers. And if we see that whole process from beginning to end as one long continuous thing, which we call disciple making, then there is no distinction between mission and discipleship. It's time to get those two things, those two words, and those the things that represent those two words out of the silos and into a place of integration. So that's the first thing. The second thing is I think that we've tended to relegate mission and discipleship to a few specialist people. We sometimes call them evangelists and pastors, rather than seeing it the work of every member being called to be not only a witness, but also a disciple maker. If we look at that scripture in Ephesians 4, it says to each one, the grace is given, some as apostles, prophets, pastors, teachers, and evangelists, for the equipping of the saints for the work of service. We're all involved in helping build that disciple-making pipeline, if you like, rather than it being just the work of the evangelists and pastors. Each one is involved. And each one of us are called to that great commission of Matthew 28. I think the third problem is that we've tended to suffer from managing church rather than multiplying disciples. Somebody's once said that if we make disciples, Jesus will build his church. Unfortunately, we often focus on building the church. And if you focus on that, you don't often get disciples at the end of it. You tend to get programs, you get activities, you get services, you get events, but you don't get a real ongoing growth of multiplying disciples. And in those cases where we end up managing church ends up being limited to the capacity of its leader rather than seeing the whole church mobilized as disciple makers, where there's really unlimited potential for growth, which is really where it gets exciting. The fourth thing I think is that we often have inherited models of church which really don't bear much resemblance to either the way Jesus operated or the way the early church operated. So for example, if you focus on the Gospels and the way Jesus made disciples, it's really very different to how we think about it today. As I said earlier, we often see disciple making as putting on some courses for people to attend as to how to be more mature Christians, rather than inviting people to share our lives and our journey discipleship and walking with Jesus, where apprenticeship, modeling, and imitation are far more the key activities that are involved in growing and making disciples, rather than the programmatic teaching basis that many of us use in our churches, which we call discipleship. If we look at the Gospels, Jesus he did spend time with the crowds, he spent time teaching them, but probably more of his time, if not most of his time, was spent actually with a smaller group of disciples who he poured his life into, let him watch what he was doing, gave him opportunities to do what he was doing, helped them, encouraged them, picked them up when they were falling or sinking in the sea, as in Peter's case, and encouraged them to keep having another go until they got it. And somehow, miraculously, at the end of 3 years, in what seemed like an impossible task, he had raised at least 11 full-on disciples and maybe 70 in total who knew something of what they were meant to be doing, disappeared, filled them with his Holy Spirit, and left them to continue a movement which we stand in the wake of today. We're here today because those first disciples got it. They understood what it meant to go and make disciples. And we've sadly lost Jesus' ways. We talk a lot about his words, his works, and his wonders, but not so many talk about his ways. How did Jesus actually make disciples? Well, he spent time with them. He invited them to follow. He invited them into his life. He shared his life with them. He let them do what he was doing. It was so much of it was by imitation, much more than just the transmission of information, which is how we tend to do stuff. Jesus also put the focus on disciple making rather than Sunday services, for example. So our programs, we tend to put a huge amount of emphasis on Sunday services. A lot of our resources go into them. And if we think about both how Jesus and the early church operated, probably our balance of use of resources could do with a little adjustment, to put it mildly. Billy Graham was asked in 1958, what he would do if he wasn't a travelling evangelist but was a local minister. It's interesting, his answer. He said in Christianity magazine, Christianity Today, he said, "I think one of the first things I would do would be to get a small group of 8 or 10 or 12 men around me that would meet a few hours a week and pay the price. It would cost them something in time and effort. I would share with them everything I have over a period of years. Then I would actually have 12 ministers among the laymen who in turn could take 8 or 10 or 12 more and teach them." Billy Graham understood something about the process of disciples who make disciples. So that's the fourth thing, which is looking at the ways Jesus did things and the way the early church did things. The early church not only understood the disciple-making process, but they had a context and a vehicle through which to do that, which we read about in the New Testament. Usually it's referred to as the church in the house of so-and-so or the home of so-and-so. We read about it in Acts 2, where they break bread, shared meals together, and went from house to house. We read about the home being the center of so much evangelistic activity in the homes, as well as the synagogues, through the book of Acts. We see in Philippi in Acts 16, Lydia's house and the Philippian jailer's house being the center of both evangelistic and disciple-making activity. And right through to Acts 20, where Paul's with the Ephesus elders, and he says, "I didn't hold back from preaching and teaching anything, both publicly and from house to house." And that sort of house church, which is normally referred in the New Testament by the Greek word oikos, or household, was their secret weapon. And the church pretty much went on exponential growth, the multiplication of both disciples and churches, because that was their primary vehicle for both mission and discipleship for the first 300 years. So it wasn't until Constantine came in the 300s that church buildings were actually allowed to be owned by Christians. So for the first 300 years, yes, they did meet publicly where they had the opportunity. In the early days, it was in the synagogues before they were thrown out. In places like Ephesus, Paul went to the hall of Tyrannus to teach the disciples. The early church history says often the house churches would gather in the crypts and caves, burial places, where they could gather more people. But primarily, the primary tool was oikos, church in the house, the household, the extended household. It wasn't just a nuclear family's house as we think of it today. It was an extended household where both the family, the extended family, aunts, uncles, grandparents, the slaves, the servants, the work colleagues, the neighbors, those people they traded with from that home, all of which could mount up to 20 to 50 or even 70 people, would gather in these courtyard-based homes as house church. The epistles talk about them. The church of Philemon that was in Colossae, the house church of Nympha, referred to in Colossians, which was probably in Laodicea, and the house church of Priscilla and Aquila, which is referred to in Romans. This was the secret tool. It was not the house group as we know it, because they were clearly centers of gospel evangelistic activity. Not the cell groups as we know it, which were limited in size, but it could grow to quite a significant number of people. And it was through that oikos, that household, that the church grew and multiplied for 300 years. And in fact, as soon as the church got its buildings, it started to go into decline into the Dark Ages as it became institutionalized and the priesthood became professionalized. So it's a fascinating historical insight. And these centers of mission, these household centers of mission and discipleship, really shared the burden of disciple making and of evangelism. We often use the phrase idea that it takes a whole village to raise a child. That's the African proverb. And my strong conviction is it takes a whole community, a house church, a missional community to make disciples, because we all play a part in the process. It's not primarily a one-on-one process, which we've made it. It's a whole community activity working together. Final reason I think we've struggled is that we don't really have agreed language, tools, and processes that are simple, sticky, and reproducible. So some of the things that we've worked with over the last few years have been things called life shapes, like the circle and the triangle, which have been really helpful tools to help us disciple people and define some simple language that anybody can use to help raise disciples in a context of community. So that's just a little bit of thinking about why we need to change our approach to mission and discipleship, why it's not really worked that well in the past, and why missional community probably is the tool that we need, or the vehicle that we most need to get our heads around and embrace if we're going to do this differently and see something change. As the saying goes, if you want something, you want to see a different outcome, you've got to do something different to get there. And the definition of insanity is doing the same thing and expecting a different result. So we have to think differently, and we have to discover some different practices if we're going to be really effective, I believe, in mission and discipleship. So I'll just take a few minutes just to share a few of the missional communities that I think are working well up this end, not just from our own church, but other churches around us that are engaged in this journey. And it is a journey of discovery. We're all still on that journey. None of us have got it all figured out yet. We're all trying to learn from each other as we go along. But we've found a few things that do seem to work and are quite encouraged so far. So I'll just mention a couple that in our own church. One's called Studio. It's a community that was together for about 5 years. I think it's closed down now because of people moving away in different life stages, but it was mainly young adults and young marrieds initially who had a real desire to reach out to the arts community. They were a creative bunch themselves. One of the first things they did as a community, as well as meeting to pray and love each other and eat together and look at the scriptures, was to open up some creative writing evenings which they could invite their friends to. And I went along to one in the early days, and it was the first time I'd written any poetry for about 40 years, I think. It was quite amusing. They probably had about 30 or 40 people there, of which at least half were not yet Christians. It was a great context for just mixing it up and inviting people to be part of their community. They went on eventually to pretty much dominate a comedy club. It was a small little comedy club they started going to, which they initially were horrified when they went there. The humor was so crude. They thought, oh, dear, what have we done? How could we have brought our community to this terrible place? But the Lord really challenged them to stay there and to see what difference they could make. And because they were quite a significant number, they were quite a high proportion of the actual audience. And so, you know, some of the jokes that they didn't appreciate didn't get the laughs, and some of the ones they did. And gradually, even the culture of the humor began to change. After a while, the owner became very friendly with them. He started coming along to some of their community activities. The couple who led the community were offered to do some stand-up, which they'd never done before, which they actually did pretty well. And the wife is actually very good at it and has gone on to make a bit of a name for herself. And the owner himself started to come along to some of their community stuff. They actually were given opportunities to lead some of their whole nightclub evenings from their Christian perspective, which is amazing, really. That was just one example. A couple of examples of geographical communities here in Liverpool. One was called Outrageous Love. One was called the Cressington Community, both of which were on relatively new housing estates. And the Cressington one started their journey by just getting to know the neighbours, starting to run activities for the kids on the estate, Easter egg hunts, bonfire nights, Christmas carols. They started a Facebook page for all the new people moving into the estate, because it was literally a brand new estate. Over time, the church community became the glue of that wider community. There's probably several hundred houses there. And they became the de facto organizing committee, if you like, for pretty much everything that happens on that estate. It's been remarkable over the years. They've seen a number of people come to faith and be integrated to church life just by being there and being the community base for that new housing estate. Similar stuff for the other community, Outrageous Love. They recently ran an Easter egg hunt in one of the local parks. They had dozens of their community come and join them. The kids loved it. book everyone back for a barbecue afterwards. Just building relationships, throwing parties, having fun, and serving the neighbours where they see needs arising. The community that Jenny and I run is it was a fairly sort of wide spread geographical community, but as we've multiplied, we've begun to focus more on the streets where Jenny and I live. One of the things we did at Christmas was just throw a Christmas party, inviting as many neighbours as we could find. And as a result of that, starting to just build new friendships with people that we hadn't met before, trying to get to know the street, finding needs that we can meet. A girl in the social housing opposite where Jenny and I live was always getting herself into trouble, always knocking on our door, and just finding ways of blessing her and serving her. So just lots of encouraging people of peace on the journey, some of whom have come to faith. Out in St. Helens, there's a parish church there which has run a community called Base Camp. They started off with 14 people 18 months ago, mostly reaching out to family and friends, and through running Alpha courses have planted a second missional community out of that. Grace Church in Warrington, which is an Elim church just nearby, in 2015, they started off a community called Grace. Sorry, the church is called King's Church. The community is called Grace. Started off with 10 people, just in a small geographical area of 3 or 4 streets. There's also a community center in that area. And they were prayer walking. They would go and meet people in the community center. They'd put on vintage tea parties in that community center where up to 50 people would come. And out of those contacts, they'd be finding people of peace who they'd be inviting back to like a Billy Graham DVD or a Discovery Bible study, evangelistic Bible study. And out of that, I've seen 4 new believers so far come to faith and be added to their community. Another Anglican church in a sort of tough estate area of Liverpool called the church is called St. Andrew's. The community is called Switch. It's a bunch of adults who reach out to young people on the streets. They go out on the streets on a Tuesday night for the first half of the evening. They will come back and engage in more kind of core discipling activities in the second half of the evening. And gradually are starting to see some of the young people come to faith. And some of the adults they're meeting on the streets, the parents of these children, are now beginning to help out with their outreach activities, which is brilliant. They're actually getting adults into the community before they're Christians, starting on a process of discipleship, which is a great example of the kind of the journey that we invite people onto. We're discipling people long before they become Christians, and that's a real key for me. Some years ago, I used to get my hair cut by someone on the high street near where we live. Her name was Debbie, and she had a son. And Debbie was a hairdresser. She came to our church by my invitation, gave her life to Jesus, got some really powerful encounters with God, had some deliverance. Eventually, she moved away. She was always in relationship difficulties, but she settled in this area by this other church. And one day her son was out on the streets and she met this community out just reaching out to young people. And her son, I forget his name just now, but he was quite suicidal. And they met him, and just at the point where he was ready to throw the towel in, gave him a lifeline. And he actually came back to the church building that night and gave his life to Christ and has been a faithful part of that church ever since. It's just lovely to see how God joins the dots up between our different evangelistic activities. They've also had a community called Living Initiatives, which focuses on the workplace, and they've been able to see people supporting each other as they're reaching out to their friends in the workplace, and again seeing people starting to come to Christ through that. Final one, a Salvation Army church in Liverpool. They run a community called The Meeting Place, and it's reaching out to people with addiction issues. They run their evenings a little bit like an AA 12-step evening, but it's Christian-based. They look at scripture together, but they're gradually training up those people who've come out of various addictions to each one identify their own missional focus. So, for example, one of them an old guy in his 70s who's saying, well, I want to take on my street. And he's beginning to think, how can I reach my street? How can I plant a missional community in my street? And three or four of those who are being raised up and trained up by their community leader, whose name is Trish, are starting to think about their own missional context and potentially multiplying missional communities. So as you can see, that the size and shape and variation of these missional communities is infinite, but they're all based around three core elements of mission, discipleship, and community. And those really are the key elements that make these oikos, these household churches, really thrive and work. So that's where we're up to. And I guess I need to leave you to have some dialogue and ask any questions you want to now.
Brilliant. Thank you, Nick. That's fantastic. So can you see us now? Can you? Oh, good. We're back. So it was really, as you can imagine, hearing Nick, you know, conscious of our journey with launching worshipping communities. It's so great to hear from someone who's been doing it for some time and seen it and so on. Alice and I have come to these tonight and for these 5 weeks with quite a few live questions, quite a few things that we don't know the answer to, but wanting to process with the Lord. And I imagine that you have. It's been good speaking to some of you and hearing some of the questions that you've got. And over these 5 weeks, we'll explore those things. So let's take 10 minutes now and just consider maybe what our question, any questions that we've got for Nick now. You might want to discuss them with people near to you. You might want to have a little scribble in your journal. Let's just consider, you know, what questions we've got, and then we'll come back and we can ask Nick those in about 10 minutes. Okay. Great, folks. So if I can call us back together, while we've still got Nick with us, let's use this time to ask him some questions. You can hear me okay, can you, Nick? Sure. Well, I can go to whoever's got one with this. Who's going to ask a question first? Is that you, Sarah? Sarah's got a really small, practical one.
I just wanted to ask about the Living Initiatives workplace missional community, please.
Did you hear that? Sarah wanted to ask about the Living Initiatives workplace missional community. Could you expound upon that a little bit, please?
Yeah, sure. The workplace is a very interesting one because there are lots of different aspects to what could or might happen in a workplace context. I think it's probably good to go back to the sort of first principle that we talked about, which is our primary call being to make disciples. Now, I believe that, you know, we all want to be salt and light wherever God places us. And for many of us, that is, for a significant part of our day, is in the workplace. We want to be salt and light. We want to be good adverts for Jesus. We want to be able to demonstrate Jesus, to talk about Jesus as the circumstances permit. But we all are very aware of the limitations that the workplace will put on us in terms of, well, we're there to do a job of work, not to be chatting to other people all the time. You know, we're under pressure. We're busy. There may be a turnover of work colleagues. We may not be in the same place long periods of time. We may be traveling. There's lots of things that actually make disciple making quite difficult. For example, if you're in a school, then there's a real taboo on any kind of evangelization, or the same would be true in a hospital. All sorts of workplaces would frown on you if you try to use that opportunity to evangelize others, let alone make disciples. So there are real limitations on what can be done in the workplace. But I do know that there are quite a number of people have successfully run groups and done outreach activities in the workplace where they've had the boldness to overcome the fears of what might happen, or they've had explicit permission to do so. I remember one guy in the church who's not with us anymore. He's moved to Australia, but he successfully ran alpha courses several times in the workplace in the lunch break. And again, there again, lunch breaks are not always that consistent, so that can be difficult too. Others I know have run small discipleship groups at work for people who are Christians. Sometimes just small triplets, groups of three, using particular materials to help them process what it means to be a disciple, a follower of Jesus, both at work and in life in general. And where space, where time, and where the authority of the workplace allow, there's all sorts of different things that can be done. But if we believe that the best discipleship takes place in the context of community rather than on a one-on-one basis, then probably we're going to want to try and draw people who we have interaction with at work back into a more home-based community at the end of the day, where they're exposed to a breadth of Christians, a breadth of demonstrations of what Jesus is like and what it means to be a follower, where the whole village raises the child, so to speak. So the workplace can be a fruitful place. It's hard, I think, to make missional community as a sort of simple model, work in the workplace for all the reasons I've given, but it can be a place where we find people at peace and where people come to faith and where we then get the opportunity to invite them into our communities, which are home-based at the end of the day. So I think that's my first thought on the workplace, unless you want to come back at me with anything.
Great. Thanks, Nick. Next question is Rog.
Hi, Nick. It's Roger here. Nick, have you come across Christian workplace groups with this organisation called Transform Work UK? So it's just building on what you've been saying there, but very much trying to build community from a whole variety of Christians, you know, in the workplace, where under sort of diversity rules, for example, of the companies, you're very much allowed and given permission to have your Christian workplace group there. And out of that group, you know, able to pray for the company and there's a sort of a community feel in the workplace, which sort of builds on just that one-on-one. So I don't know if that's something that you've come across, because those could be examples of sort of missional communities in the workplace. Thanks.
Yeah, I've not come across that by name. I'm aware of the work of Mark Green and the London Institute of Contemporary Christianity with lots of different workplace initiatives. As we're beginning to work into different towns and cities at a city-wide level, I think one of the things that is really helpful is to connect people from different churches who are operating in the same field of work, particularly people who feel called to really influence that sector, that particular area of the workplace. But I'm not familiar with that specific name as such.
Thanks, Rog. Crofty, did you have something?
What do you mean by people of peace?
Give us a quick intro. We're going to go into a lot more actually next week, but it'll be great to hear from you as well, Nick.
All right. Well, a person of peace is a term that's picked up from Luke 10, where Jesus sent out the disciples to preach the gospel. And in each town and village they go to, he tells them to look for the person of peace, the man of peace, which is someone who receives you and welcomes you into their home, gives you hospitality, likes you, listens to you. And that's the person that Jesus says, stay with them. So even though they're scattering a lot of gospel seed as they go, the people Jesus tells them to stay with are the people of peace. They're the really receptive people. So I won't say more than that, other than to give an example or two from my own experience. So I volunteer as a magistrate. One of the people who I met in magistrate's court, a guy called Trevor, he was a district judge. And when he found out I was a Christian, and particularly as a pastor, he decided I was fair game, and he would wind me up and tease me and try and publicly humiliate me in front of the other magistrates. It was all good-natured. It was banter. But a friendship grew out of that, and I've invited him to church a couple of times. He came to a Christmas service eventually. And long story short, at the end of the day, he he liked what he saw in church, and he asked if I would marry him and his girlfriend. He added quickly. He had a multiple girlfriends all over the place, but this was one he was now settling down with. He was in his early 60s, so he was no spring chicken. And eventually, I couldn't quite understand why he wanted me to marry him and his girlfriend, because our church is it's an old shed of a place, nothing beautiful about it. But he said, no, I like your church, Nick, and we like you. And then when the wedding finally came, all the good and the great came to it. All other judges and magistrates came. But he said to all of the people, we don't want any wedding gifts. You know, we've got all the possessions we need, but we'd like you to give towards the work of Frontline Church in the Democratic Republic of Congo, our Love Congo project. And what he was demonstrating was not only that he was open and interested, but also that he wanted to bless us and serve us, which automatically my antennae went up thinking, oh, this is interesting. He's probably a person of peace. We said to him, well, if I'm going to marry you, you're going to have to do is marriage preparation, and I'd like you to do an Alpha course. And he didn't do that immediately, but he did eventually. Him and his new wife did an Alpha course, and both came back to what I later discovered was a childhood faith that had before, briefly became part of our community before they moved away from the city. But that kind of process of discovering someone's, you know, they like you, they want to be around you, they listen to you, and they want to serve you were all keys for me in understanding that this was a person of peace that I should really invest in and spend time with. So I won't say more than that.
Can I ask two questions? The first one is, if you had to put a percentage on it in terms of where you've seen new disciples come, what percentage would be just time spent with people, and what percentage would be that sort of more intentional, look, come and do this course, or, you know, sort of that more sort of program-based, look, come and we're going to deliberately talk about some things. So that's question number one, and then I'll ask the next one after that, if that's right.
Okay, let me respond to that first then. What we've found is that as well as praying and being present in our communities and serving and blessing our communities, as well as looking for people of peace, we also needed to create pathways to faith for people. So, for example, in our own community, which we call Eat, Love, Pray, because that's what we do, we once or twice a year will run an Alpha course in the home. It's not a centralized program. It's something we do as a community. We run it in our front room, and just two or three people from the community help out. And really, it's a way of helping all the members of the community who are all looking for people of peace. It's a place to invite them where they can go on a specific journey to discover Jesus. So, for example, Helen in our community came across somebody at work who she thought was perhaps a person of peace, invited her to the community. She came along to the Alpha course, and we're really not sure when she became a Christian, because she so loved the community that she just wanted to hang around us all the time. She was a sort of classic belong before you believe kind of person. As Emily came to faith, she was just, because she'd been part of our household, and as in the Alpha course, the most natural thing in the world for her was just to continue to be part of our household community, which she did. It was like it was a seamless thing. It wasn't like she did a program and then she came to community. So most people that have come to faith in our community have been people that we've met in the workplace, in the local sort of area, in the neighborhood, or through other friendship activities, invited to the community and been part of that community. Sometimes we've run intentional things to help people on their journeys of faith. So if we took sort of percentage-wise across all the communities that I've mentioned to you, I would say the majority have come through relationship, through community, through just watching how other people are living, and the minority have come to faith initially in some kind of programmatic way, Sunday service activity, you know, centralized Alpha course way. And if I was to guess, I would say it's probably like something like 80-20, but that would just be a guess.
Great, thank you. Yeah.
Let's maybe hear some. Yeah, here.
Hello. I was just, I've noticed whenever I've been part of a group or a community, it feels like one of the big challenges is that people are often pulled in lots of different directions in life, and people are often part of lots of different things, whether it's work or family or friends outside of their core community. And then when people are sort of come to the group that we're running, it's like, how do you get a group to form a community where it's all everybody's primary goal? That's their community, that's their baby, that's the thing that they really want to grow in and see grow. Does it feel like the community has to drop lots of other stuff in life to really form around a goal to see it bear fruit and grow? Or is it just so naturally part of life that people can do lots of other things, but they just return to the community? Does that make sense?
Okay, I think I've got the gist of the question, which is sort of all the very different activities that people are involved in. How does that work when you're trying to build community? Do they have to drop some of those, or is it just sort of the natural rhythms of the community that takes over? I'm hoping that's something like the question you were asking. I think this is a very common question, and it is a very significant issue, because we live in a very pressured, fast-paced world where work wants its pound of flesh out of you. You know, family demands are high. Children are being bussed around, taxied around to all sorts of different activities, after-school activities, weekend activities. And it feels like there's very little left for church. And if we make it to church on a Sunday, we've done well, tick that box. You know, is there anything left for anything other than a Sunday service, where generally children are being looked after, so we get a bit of a break from our kids if we've got young families? So there is a reality about people in the sort of peak of their careers, the demands of their jobs. There is a reality around families with young children who are at a very busy stage of life. There's two things I think that are key. As I've observed them. One is that we recognize that we actually have the lives we have chosen to live. And we often feel like we're victims to our circumstances of work or family, or, you know, doing up an old house, or, you know, the things that just preoccupy so many of us for such a lot of our time. We are actually, you know, or even, you know, both partners working full time, which we tend to assume is a given these days for, you know, for mums either before they've had children or after they've had children, for dads to be out to work full time. We tend to assume that's the norm. But actually, a lot of these things are within a level of choice. We do have a level of choice around them. And we generally have the life that we choose. And we can make different choices. We're not victims to our circumstances. We create the life that we want. And if we want a life that includes authentic Christian community, then there are probably some different choices we're going to make about the priorities of how we spend our time, what we spend our money on, how much of our soul we sell to our workplace, you know, how many other activities outside of church we're getting involved in with us or our children. There are probably some different choices and some other priorities that we're going to start focusing on, because we do have choice. That's the first thing. The second thing is that it is possible, I think, to build community around the things that we are already doing. So I know one community, for example, where it's mainly families with young children. And so a lot of those families will tend to go to the park on a Saturday morning. Well, that's a very natural opportunity, both for them as to hang out and build friendship. It's also an opportunity for them to invite their neighbors, friends along, just to hang out with them and be part of their community. So trying to fit in with the rhythms that already exist and build on those rhythms is another way of sort of, if you like, recycling the time, the little time that we do have. We all eat on average 21 meals a week, some more, some less. Well, let's do that with some other folks in the church. Let's invite some yet to become believers along into some of those meals. Let's maybe have one meal a week where we just have an, you know, open policy. We'll cook extra food and invite extra people in. You know, there are things that we're already doing that we can do with others, and we can make part of our community's life. So we don't try and add lots of new activities, but we try and use the ones we're already in to build community. I think that does work, but it does mean being very intentional about it. It doesn't just happen by accident. It happens because we make an intention for that to happen, and we think creatively about how it can happen. We build our communities around those rhythms that work for us. So I think it's a mixture of those two things. Hopefully that just gives you a couple of handles to pull on.
Thanks, Nick. We could probably do maybe two. Let's do two more questions. Go, Hannah.
So do you actually have a Sunday service still?
Yes, we do have Sunday services. We are trying to put less emphasis on them. And we're also giving permission to our missional communities, if they want to do stuff on a Sunday instead of coming to a Sunday service, partly because we recognize that time is precious. And if all of their capacity, or if you like, their sort of spare time is taken up with a Sunday activity, they've got nothing left for anything else, then why not use that time to help build community? It is also a Sunday morning is often the time when not yet Christians are out and about and are at a loose end, aren't often able to do things with us on those occasions. So our community, for example, we will tend to be at 3 out of 4 Sunday services, and the fourth one, which is this next coming Sunday, we'll do a brunch. We'll do an 11 till 1 o'clock brunch. Come along, invite your friends. You know, we'll have fun, a bit of a party, but we'll also bring some spiritual elements to that, which any invited guests can happily be a part of. But because it's a big enough group, won't feel awkward or embarrassed if they don't want to join in. They can just sit and watch and enjoy. So, yes, there's a lot of freedom in our own church about how frequently people come to Sunday services, because we do want to give people the space to use that opportunity to build their missional communities, and particularly where it's missionally strategic to do so.
Thank you, Nick. Now, I'm sure we've got lots more questions. We'll just do one more. They might be things that you want to be considering over these next 5 weeks. Write them in your notebooks, your journals. There's a flip chart there next to Hugh. And if you want us to kind of consider them from the front sort of thing, then write them on there as well. We'll just come to you, Alex.
No pressure on the last question. Nick, you mentioned pathways to faith in one of your answers, pathways to faith, and you've frozen. You mentioned about Alpha, I think, within your own community, but what other pathways to faith have you found to be effective?
Okay, thank you. What other pathways to faith have we found effective? Alpha is certainly a good one. The Christianity Explored version is also good for churches that prefer that particular menu. There's something called the story of God, which has been pioneered by a guy from the States called Cesar Kalinowski. If you go on his website, caesarkalinowski.com, all the materials are there. You really need to be trained to do it, but you get a flavor of what it's about. It's a way of telling the whole story of the Bible, engaging people dialogically in that story over a number of weeks. And it's great for discipling Christians, but it's also brilliant for drawing non-Christians into a journey of faith. There's something called the 7 signs of John's Gospel, which is a specific form of the generic discovery Bible study. In the 7 signs, if you Google Neil Cole and 7 signs in John's Gospel, you'll get the passages that he used. Basically, it's the 7 miracles in John's Gospel that are shared together with the group, who are a mixture of Christians and non-Christians. And then it's asking the sort of classic discovery Bible study questions, like, what does this tell us about God? What does this tell us about people? What does this say about you and me? What do we want to do about it? And who are we going to tell? Those are kind of classic discovery Bible study questions. I've used both general discovery Bible study and the specific 7 signs to good effect with non-Christians. They love engaging in the discovery process and being part of digging into those Bible passages and the stories from John. So those are a few other things we've found helpful. I'm sure there are plenty more, but that's just a few.
Well, thank you for being with us this evening. It's been great to hear your story, really inspiring. You're very good at answering questions.
I love the Q&A, actually. It's my favourite bit.
Is it? Okay, great. Well, should we give Nick a cheer? Yeah.
Thank you. And thanks for listening. Thanks for allowing me to be part of your very first one of these gatherings. I feel very privileged to have been in the room with you. And somehow, despite the technology, we managed to get through. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Nick. All right, we'll press the red button. Say goodbye.
Okay, God bless you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
So, folks, this has been great. We've cracked something open here. And as we say, you know, we'll use this time to take your journals away, bring them back each time, you know, process stuff with the Lord, with each other. Maybe people that have asked certain questions that you'd like to chat with as a follow-up. Might be you want to write questions on here. If you would like to do some extra reading, there's some books on that table behind Wen Yong and for you to look at. You might even be able to borrow one or two of them. I think the Cesar Kalinowski one is really... let me just flag two. I'll flag three. This is a brilliant... he was talking about people of peace. And this is about people becoming Christians in the Muslim world through the whole people of peace thing. And it's extraordinary, hundreds of stories. It's mostly in Africa, but the principles, I think, are very transferable. Really just inspiring, lovely bedtime reading. Yeah, you concur. He mentioned Cesar Kalinowski. He mentioned Cesar Kalinowski, the guy with a handlebar moustache. We're going to have a week with him where we're going to use some of his material in a few weeks' time. This book is called Small is Big, Slow is Fast. And that's great on just sort of lifestyle, rhythms of life, home, that sort of thing. He's very, very good. And then this one, Family on Mission, a chap called Mike Breen led St. Thomas Crooks in Sheffield and really started the whole missional communities thing. We call them worshipping communities. Most people call them missional communities. We're recognizing that we're a church and a prayer center intertwined, people of worship, people of prayer. Goodbye, Reeds. Love you guys. See ya. Okay, we're going to finish there just before 9:30. It's exciting doing this with you, and we're back here same time next week.